You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
It's Friday, June 9th, 2023, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The Waltine Nauta indictment has been released, and things do not look good for this Guamese former naval officer who texted extensively about the issues of Palm Beach document storage. Also caught up in Waltgate, Donald J. Trump. The former president, intent on making history, kept classified documents, lied about keeping classified documents, and floated this question to lawyers. Wouldn't it be better if we just told them we don't have anything here? Yes, but only if you really didn't have anything there. And also if you hadn't been using your lawyer to obstruct justice, which torpedoes attorney-client privilege. Those attorneys, by the way, have left the case. But the 15 cases of documents moved from room to room at Mar-a-Lago, according to the indictment. All of this is according to the indictment. In fact, there were certain pages of those documents, including a war plan against Iran drawn up by General Milley, that made its way to Bedminster, New Jersey, where Trump produced it to visitors, including a writer who was working on a book. Now, the intent was to wow him. Did it work? Let me read from the transcript. Trump, well with... And then Millie's name is redacted, but it's Millie. Let me see that. I'll show you an example. He said that I wanted to attack country A. It's Iran. Isn't it amazing? I have a big pile of papers. This thing just came up. Look, this was him. They presented me this. This is off the record, but they presented me this. This was him. This was the Defense Department and him. Writer, wow. It worked. It wowed him. And it represents one of seven federal counts against him. Special Prosecutor Jack Smith talked briefly to the public today and explained why what Trump did was serious.
Our laws that protect national defense information are critical to the safety and security of the United States, and they must be enforced. Violations of those laws put our country at risk. Adherence to the rule of law is a bedrock principle of the Department of Justice. And our nation's commitment to the rule of law sets an example for the world. We have one set of laws in this country, and they apply to everyone. Applying those laws, collecting facts, that's what determines the outcome of an investigation. Nothing more and nothing less. The prosecutors in my office are among the most talented and experienced in the Department of Justice. They have investigated this case hewing to the highest ethical standards, and they will continue to do so as this case proceeds. It's very important for me to note that the defendants in this case must be presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in a court of law. To that end, my office will seek a speedy trial in this matter, consistent with the public interest and the rights of the accused. We very much look forward to presenting our case to a jury of citizens in the Southern District of Florida. In conclusion, I would like to thank the dedicated public servants of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, with whom my office is conducting this investigation, and who work tirelessly every day upholding the rule of law in our country. I'm deeply proud to stand shoulder to shoulder with them. Thank you very much.
Smith then unwittingly voiced the number one defense being presented right now on Truth Social among MAGA Nation and by Trump himself.
We have one set of laws in this country, and they apply to everyone.
Exactly, the Trumpistas said. And Mike Pence and Joe Biden took documents too. Hey, they gave him back, yeah, when asked, but, and they didn't lie about it, sure, but they took documents too. They did it too. That's the defense, to which the judges, I'm sure, are going to say, wait, are you saying they did it too? Well, as you know, under federal law, if more than one person breaks a law, then all parties are allowed to break the law. Let me know. Hold on one second. I have to contact the criminal courts and the jails. Sir, do you have murderers locked up there? You do. Well, let me ask you this. Do you have more than one murderer? Ah, well, the first one could go because if the other guy did it too, then he's off the hook. In fact, the second guy could go if a third person did it. What? There were 20,000 murders last year. They can all go. If it was only one, we'd have to punish him. But since there were more than one, they did it too. Under the doctrine of they did it too, they're all free to go. I'll stop now. This is getting ridiculous. But you know what? Who knows? Maybe the judge will say this. The judge is Trump appointee Eileen Cannon, who previously ruled in favor of Trump and was almost immediately harshly rebuked by higher-ups on the 11th Circuit. It's unclear, by the way, if Cannon will stay on for the duration of the case, but she will be presiding when Trump appears in her Florida courthouse. That is scheduled for Tuesday, which, judging by Trump's appearance in New York State courthouse 2 months ago, will cause workers to weep and apologize for having to fingerprint him. Because that is how deeply Americans feel for Waltine Nauta and his co-conspirator, a guy named Trump. On the show today, it is another full show Friday. Ooh, I just coined a phrase. I invented a format. Well, I have a really good full show. The Geography of Bliss is a 2009 nonfiction book in which Eric Weiner went to the happiest and sometimes the least happy countries in the world to figure out happiness, what makes people happy. The television version of The Geography of Bliss is out now on Peacock, and Rainn Wilson is our grumpy guide, or in his case, more specifically, our anxious American serving up this travelogue. My conversation with Rainn and Eric is good. It gets heated at times. We're going to play the whole thing. I also write about it in today's Pesca Profundities Substack. Lots of charts and deep dives and specific statistics there, as befits the Substack format. But this here is an audio, blissful, knockdown dragout with me, Eric Weiner, and Rainn Wilson. Enjoy.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
To understand happiness, I'll need to embrace what comes my way.
Why do this?
Because you can.
In Los Angeles, we barely know the people that we live near.
Here, everybody's family.
If we want to do this old school Icelandic way, we really should drop our trunks.
The Geography of Bliss is a new show on the Peacock Network. It's part travelogue, part psychotherapy, and part sociological research. It's based on the book of the same name written by Eric Weiner, who I work with for many years at NPR. And Rainn Wilson is the host, and more than the host, it really is filtered through his sensibility, if you know about many of the things that the star of The Office and many other TV shows and movies has been into with his production company, Soul Pancake. That's what they're talking about. They're going to different places, or Rainn is, and figuring out what makes people happy. What are the keys to happiness? Sort of a lifelong quest that both of these guys are compelled to undertake, and they join me now. Rainn and Eric, welcome back to The Gist. And Rainn, welcome to The Gist.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So before we even start, how much, I know that books get optioned and then they get pitched to, you know, different people who could turn them into TV shows. Let's say, how much interaction have you guys had in creating this project?
Well, I'll jump in. Fairly little. I'd like to have more. We haven't even like really gotten to sit down and have a meal together. But these two young producers just wrote me out of the blue. And they're like, hey, we got the rights to this book. I'm so sorry, Eric. I hadn't heard of the book before. And
that's okay. They said, I hadn't heard of The Office before, so we're even.
Yeah, perfect. And I was like, wow, this is really compelling. And then I read the book and I was just utterly charmed. I thought the voice was so strong. The writing was great. The concept was amazing. And I actually was like learning things as I was being greatly entertained. And I was like, you're right. This is a great TV show. And then not long after that, had a conversation, I think a Zoom or a call or something with Eric. But from my end, it's been pretty minimal. But obviously, the book and the vision are all Eric's. The central concept and idea of a flawed narrator,
right,
searching for happiness on both sociologically and psychologically and humorously-logically, was what all came from Eric. And yeah.
Well, if I can jump in, Rain, we did have a phone call, and if you recall, just before you hit the road, I sent you like a 2 or 3 page memo about by email about how to get people to talk about happiness.
But you did have return receipt on, and you have no knowledge that you ever read the memo, right?
No, we said this is really helpful. I do recall that. But the truth is, it's actually kind of harder than you might think to explore happiness and to get people to talk about it. I mean, Mike, you know that if you put a microphone in front of someone and ask them to hold forth about the misery in their life, they just keep going and going. But if you ask people if they're happy and they say yes, and you ask why, you get an answer like, I just am, you know, which doesn't make for great radio or television. So you have to kind of tease it out of people, because I think people don't normally sit around thinking, if they are happy, thinking about why they're happy, because they're too busy being happy.
Right. And then there's the idea that the unexamined life is not worth living. And Eric, you touch on this in the Socrates Express. But maybe one reason why people don't engage in an understanding or an examination of happiness is the idea that ignorance is bliss. And if you think about it too much, you might become unhappy. I actually think it's that reverses cause and effect. We might be talking about cause and effect a lot here, that the people who dwell on it, that the people for whom the search for happiness is constant in their brain, it's not that they have a flaw, or it's not that they mistakenly began thinking about it. It's the absence of this thing that they perceive other people to have that drives them to think about nothing other than that. But did you find any of that in your writing, Eric?
Yeah. I mean, to paraphrase Socrates, the overexamined life is not worth living either. So there's a balance. And I think the conclusion I reached, that I think Rain reaches as well, is that happiness it's a byproduct of a life lived well. You can't try to be happy and then be happy. You can do things that we know lead to happiness, like, you know, have good social connections, exercise, have purpose and meaning in your life, and then one day you realize you're happy. But you don't want to think about that too long, because as soon as you become aware of your happiness, it slips away. You know, it's this state where if you shine a light on it, it just scurries away. So the trick is to do things that lead to this side effect called happiness without actively consciously pursuing them, if that makes sense.
That, by the way, I've been in this happiness business for a long time, because long before the show, we were examining this through positive psychology experiments on my media company, Soul Pancake. And I had read the happiness hypothesis, you know, by Jonathan Haidt, came out 12 years ago. I've been looking into this. That was, Eric, you just summarized it better than anyone in, you know, 90 seconds, better than anything I've ever heard, in the previous 10 years. So,
that's the NPR background speaking. So
that, but that
we have
was
limited
so,
time.
That was so beautifully succinct, you know? Yeah. And that's why this idea of in the American DNA, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I think has gotten us really fucked up, because how do you pursue happiness? You can't pursue happiness. Mm. Like, you know, if you're sitting on a bench in Central Park, licking an ice cream cone and a butterfly lands on your shoulder and you feel happy, then, okay, I want to pursue that happiness. So I'm going to buy two ice cream cones the next day and put, you know, butterfly, food on my shoulder and it doesn't come back and I'm not happy. And then I buy the ice cream cart and I'm frantically trying to recapture something. It has nothing to do with the ice cream and the butterfly. It's a residual effect of a certain state of mind. You might be in the same situation the next day and not feel happiness at all. So, life, liberty, and the pursuit of, you know, a life well lived, or, you know, I talk about, sometimes about the Greek idea of eudaimonia, of, you know, human flourishing, life, liberty, and the pursuit of human flourishing, then residually you might feel happiness a little bit more out of that. I think it's a really important conversation for us to be having.
Yeah. And I think one thing Rain and I agree on, because I've heard you say it and I've said it, is we don't love the word happiness. It's not a great
word.
Well,
your book happiness wasn't in the title of your book.
No, it wasn't. And right. And by the end of the book, spoiler alert, I conclude that, as Rain said, this Greek idea of eudaimonia, which is often translated as happiness, but really, as he says, means flourishing, a full life, a complete life. And, you know, like Aristotle thought that happiness and virtue were linked, that you could not be a happy bank robber or a happy embezzler. Like, but today we would say, well, you could be a bank robber, which, you know, objectively is bad for society, but you could feel happy and that's okay. And the ancient Greeks thought, no, that's not the case.
Yeah, I also think there's something about contentedness. So maybe contentedness doesn't reach the levels of flourishing, but I don't know. You could either look at it like, if you are content, you'd be the kind of person disinclined to say something interesting to a documentarian or NPR reporter about happiness. On the other hand, that's a state, and I understand why Jefferson wouldn't put it in the Declaration of Independence. There's nothing aspirational about it. You don't rebel against a king in order to achieve contentment. But perhaps that's the state we should be going for.
So I would say that if we're parsing words, mm-hmm. I would say that joy is the most powerful of all of those words, because, again, contentment is residual in a lot of life choices, you know. So, for instance, if you practice meditation and you have Buddhist practices of detachment or non-attachment, you might feel contentment more, but it's a residual effect of other practices. Joy is something that you can decide to do. Like I can decide to kind of bring joy into my life. I can also decide, if I'm not feeling joy personally in my chest, to give joy to other people. And it's one of the most powerful tools for healing that we have. So I can feel like crap, and Mike, I can know that you're down in the gills, and I can be like, I'm going to call my friend Mike and I'm going to bring him a rhubarb pie. And Mike is like, wow, I feel loved. I feel seen. Thank you so much. And then by the way, residually, you get more happiness, as a reaction to your kind of act of joyful service, and it increases joy. So that's another way of looking at this rubric.
Yeah. So you said something, as long as we're talking about words, I would say a large part of this project, both these projects, the book form, the documentary, is to come up with some words or some conceptions that maybe will spark in the viewer an insight. Maybe it will inspire them to change, but mostly it will just reframe in an intellectually stimulating way. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, if we could do that, I'd buy that book. I'd watch the documentary. I did, although it was probably given it gratis in both cases. But not that I'm not a Peacock subscriber. But I think the project is to get a little even deeper than, well, here are some concepts. Think about these concepts. Are you interested or excited about these concepts? Great, I've done my job. You do want to get a little deeper. And I also think that you did it in different ways. So, Eric, how do you approach that idea of we're not just doing a survey of ideas of happiness put against the geography of the world? We're trying to get something deeper here.
So first, a quick plug for my favorite travel quote ever from the writer Henry Miller, who said, "One's destination is never a place, but a new way of looking at things." And that's the point of my journey, and I think Rain's as well, was not to gain knowledge per se, that to become an expert on happiness, but to see this important concept of a happy, meaningful life from different perspectives. So even though I was traveling to a lot of the happiest places, I also traveled to some unhappy ones like Moldova, and Rain went to
Bulgaria. Yes, I was going to say Bulgaria played Moldova in the TV version. Yeah,
it did. Moldova was a little too close to Putin and Russia for for the executives.
Also, by the way, as Rain was talking about joy and pain, you have to have the sweet and the sour, and that's what the Moldova / Bulgaria presence demonstrated. But I was looking up the statistics. Bulgaria is less happy than Moldova. So in many ways, Bulgaria was maybe a better choice if you want to find the unhappy-er country.
Yeah. And I think the point of going to an unhappy place is not only the control group, you know, to compare, but I became quite fond of the Moldovans in a bizarre way. And I think it came across that Rain sort of like the Bulgarians, you know, maybe because we're both a little grumpy and we're attracted to these unhappy people. But to get back to your question, Mike, I approached this as sort of a petri dish, looked at the world as a laboratory of ideas, a what if experiment. So what if, you know, money buys you happiness? We hear it does. We think it might. So you would want to go to the wealthiest country in the world. I went to Qatar to look at the relationship between money and happiness. You know, maybe it's social connections. So you go to places with deep social connections. And it wasn't necessarily them saying, oh, you know, this is the happy place and we should all move here. It's more like, let's see how these different cultures define happiness, and not just define it, but, you know, act on it. And I want to say pursue, but I don't want to use that word, that manifested, I suppose.
So fascinating that Bulgaria has been so oppressed for centuries. I mean, we're going back like to the year 900, you know, the Ottoman Turks, the Russians, everyone has invaded their country. Then it was the Germans in World War II. Then it was famously the Soviets, and they were behind the Iron Curtain. So the Bulgarian expression or manifestation, as Eric says, of happiness is behind closed doors. You know, it's in with family, in picnics, it's inside. You couldn't trust your neighbors. There was one point in time, a third of the people in Bulgaria were spying for the government. So there can't be a social expression of happiness or joy. It had to be much more private on a smaller scale. But like weeds popping up in the cracks of the sidewalk, that's how the Bulgarians express it. And I just want to mention, Eric talked about going to Qatar, and we were going to go shoot in Dubai, and we were literally arriving in Dubai, Mike, to shoot our episode on Can Money Buy You Happiness? And the reality show Real Housewives of Dubai aired that at that exact same time, and the royal family watched Real Housewives of Dubai, and they were so incensed, outraged, and flabbergasted, they shut down all foreign production. So here we are in Dubai. We've got our cameras, we've got our crew, our vans, our locations are rented, and the Sultan or Sheikh or whomever he was like, "That's it, get out of here, you crazy kids."
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, Rain. Like, what, don't they know Real Housewives of wherever, like what it's all about?
Maybe they took the title too literally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they thought, well, these will be different. These will be Muslim housewives. So they won't swear, they won't drink, they won't get plastic surgery and throw stuff at each other. But nope, not so.
Yeah, they had to go through a hijab to get to the hair pulling, but they did. I thought you were going to say, we got to Dubai. But then the Real Housewives had been there to answer the question, can money buy you happiness? And they did such a good job, we said, what's the point? It was the definitive answer. So we should say that the cities or countries that you visited were Iceland, Bulgaria, Thailand, Ghana, and L.A. What replaced Dubai?
Well, we were also supposed to go to Japan. And I got COVID literally as my town car was pulling up to take me to the airport. I tested positive for COVID and it just threw a giant monkey wrench in everything. I was really excited to go to Japan because there's so many different ways to explore happiness in Japan. There's, you know, the ancient Shinto, you know, Zen ideas of happiness, contentment, connection with nature, up to like the modern world of Japan where people are marrying AI robots, you know? And so there's such a beautiful wide range there. So we lost two, actually. We lost Dubai and Japan. Hopefully we'll get a season two and be able to go visit those places. So LA was like a last minute addition, but I actually was really grateful for it. I think it is a terrific episode. And I think it brings it around full circle. And, you know, how can I apply what I learned on the road? Because, again, part of the show is my, as a substitute, Eric Weiner, my personal journey for happiness as well, which I talk about. How can I apply what I learned, like Henry Miller said, my shift in perspective, and bring it back to my home? And I thought it was a really touching and interesting episode.
Yeah, I did too. And it's interesting that, you know, you went back to LA. I was living in Miami, actually, when I started writing this book. And they're both places that people associate with paradise, LA and Miami, you know, palm trees, beaches.
Well, people are leaving LA for Miami, the migration pattern shift.
Yeah, but I think palm trees get in the way of happiness because it a place like LA or Miami that people associate with beauty and relaxation and drinks with little umbrellas in them, you know, that creates this expectation of happiness. Like, this is paradise. This is what the travel industry sells us. You know, it's, you know, February in Michigan and you want to be happy, you go to LA, Miami, or Cancun. And I think that expectations really get in the way of happiness, that if you take a trip or you're about to do something and you think, oh, this is going to be great, or if you think this is going to be terrible, either way, it'll interfere with your happiness, as opposed to the more Buddhist approach, which is to go into a trip or an activity with no expectations.
And we'll be back with more of Rain and Eric after this.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way, or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. We're back with The Gist. Here's a segment from The Geography of Bliss, Episode 2, Rainn Wilson Travels to Bulgaria.
So far, the only person I've met in this country found happiness by getting away from everyone else. I sympathize. My inclination is almost always to be left the hell alone. My time in Grozdvitsy makes clear what so many Bulgarians left behind.
Let's hug it out, Bulgarian.
But if I want real insight into Bulgarian sadness, into my own sadness, I'll next need a translator who's fluent in the language of misery.
So much of the unhappiness is not objectively or empirically, it's comparing yourself, and you raised this in the Bulgaria episode with, what was it, the Easterlin effect, comparing yourself to peer nations, or comparing yourself to the other people who live in your cul-de-sac, or just the idea of the hedonic adaptation, right? Where you no longer say, oh, look how good I'm doing. You just adapt to it and compare yourself to your base rate. But there's nothing, but again, it's all interesting to get insights from. I don't know how much we can do about it. I don't know how much, even if it was true that expectations or comparisons thwart happiness or looking at other countries, do we just say, therefore, I will not think in that way? Seems almost impossible.
Why the negativity, Mike? Why do you say that?
I don't think, no, it's not negative. I'm not pressuring myself to become more happy. I find it interesting that this is how happiness occurs, but I don't think that there is a 12-step program. Yes, I believe people can change a little bit, but I don't think there's this one great insight that if you change your life around it, it's going to make you happy. And I think that there's, Rainn, you're Baha'i, right?
I am.
You're a member of the Baha'i faith, and I've heard you talk about this a lot, and you find deep meaning from it. And so maybe it's the most important intellectual and spiritual component of your existence. Did that insight lead to happiness?
Well, you know, this is a very complicated conversation. I will say that I disagree with you. Before I get to the Baha'i question, I disagree with you that there is not anything you can ultimately do, because I do think that one of the most ancient spiritual philosophies in the world, in Buddhism, addresses this directly, that life is unhappiness, life is suffering, right? And the word that the Buddha used was dukkha, from the Pali, which is kind of chronic anxious dissatisfaction. Life is kind of chronic anxious dissatisfaction. This dissatisfaction is what has kept humans alive, right? Because we don't have enough. We want more. Things aren't going to work out. I better prepare for winter better. I better store more deer fur in my cave, you know? And then the solution that the Buddha offers is by saying that attachment to things, to outcomes, is that cause of suffering. And if you can release that attachment, then you can actually let go of a good deal of the suffering. It's like bad things are going to happen, but suffering is optional. And I do think that living your life in those terms can actually greatly increase the quality of your life. And it's something that I've had to learn how to do as an actor, someone in show business, where rejection, disappointment, obstacles, struggle happen all the time. And, you know, you audition, you're close between you and someone else, and you don't get it. So I have learned to be, you know, in a state of detachment, of non-attachment to outcomes. Now, I'm in a fortunate position because I have enough money. I don't have to like, oh, shit, I got to pay the rent next week. If I don't get this guest spot on Chicago Fire, I'm going to be screwed. But going to the Baha'i idea, and again, this is why sorry to plug my new book, Soul Boom, Why We Need a Spiritual Revolution. I talk about some of these items in the book. But from a Baha'i perspective, do I feel more happiness? I feel more wholeness being a Baha'i and having a spiritual mission, for having greater sense of purpose, for a greater understanding of why I'm alive and what life can offer and what paths I can take and what paths are the healthiest for the development of my soul. So yes, being a Baha'i has made me happier. I fail, I struggle, I wake up grumpy, I can be a dick sometimes, but it has overall helped me to find happiness.
Oh, I don't doubt that. And all these statistics about spirituality show that that can exist in many different faiths and many different religions. My point was that I do think people can change a bit. I do think certain types of therapy work. I do think reading insightful texts that give you insights work. But I basically think fundamentally we have our character traits. We have character or trait phenomenon. And so much of the let's talk about happiness, let's examine different religions, let's find an insight into changing how we interact with the world is very, very hard because it mistakes the state phenomenon, which is the emotional reaction to an experience, to the trait phenomenon, which is just your disposition. It mostly can't work. I love the documentary. I love the book. I love thinking about it. But I think it mostly, and for most people, it's really impossible to greatly increase your happiness, even if we use all the tools available to us.
Okay, can I jump in?
Yes.
First of all, stick to the day job. Do not go into therapy. I'm just saying.
Right? I think it could help
and,
a little.
So for a long time, the belief among psychologists that you were is basically what you're saying, that you're born genetically or dispositionally with a certain level of happiness. And one psychologist famously said that trying to be happier is like trying to be taller. Just not going to happen. And that psychologist, who since passed away, later recanted that and said, in fact, there's a range that we all have, are born with a potential range of happiness. Now, I know because of my biochemistry or my parents, probably both, I am never going to be like super happy, like Oprah levels of happiness.
Right,
it's just
right.
not going to happen.
Right.
But I think I do have a range and I can either operate at the bottom of that range or toward the top of that range. So no, you cannot change 180 degrees, but you can improve in degrees. And I think you do that through changes in perspective. And the other point I want to make is you said, you know, it's just kind of the way things are. And I think one of the points of both the book and the show is that a lot of what we assume is just the way things are, is really just the way things are. They are in New York or LA or La Paz, Bolivia. Like a lot of what we think of as sort of being universally true is really situationally and geographically true. And once you realize that, it sort of expands the world of possibilities. Maybe things are not just that way. It's just because I grew up as an American or a Bulgarian.
Right. So I forgot what context I said the way things are in. But I actually think that if one were to maximize the chances of increasing happiness, I'd engage in all the sorts of pursuits, intellectual and spiritual, that you're talking about. But probably the best thing I could do is move to a different place. I do think that geopolitics greatly influences happiness. Probably the reason that those Nordic countries are so happy is not that they have a key insight about their psychology, their psychiatry, or how to live life. They're very rich. They're among the richest nations. They have small populations. They have homogeneous populations, which I don't want to say that is part and parcel of happiness. It just seems to highly correlate. I think we could try to do it with a heterogeneous population. It just hasn't happened as much. So if we were to do a scatter graph of the things that make you happy, it's those things. It's one's unchangeable traits. It's one's country. And then much, much different is what one brings to it philosophically. Rain, go ahead.
Mike, I'm just astonished at your coal hard black little heart. That is such a skeptical idea of happiness, and it's so victim-y. I'm surprised at you. Like, we'll never change. We'll never get out. If you're born into a nice family in Sweden, you're going to be happy. Otherwise, forget about it, kid. Now listen, if you get up in the morning and you do a cold plunge, which helps slow release dopamine throughout the day, okay? If you do meditation, if you read, you know, Buddhist or Eckhart Tolle scriptures or New Age, something that inspires you, if you limit your screen time, if you exercise, if you eat right and don't eat fake carbohydrates, and if you connect with nature consciously at some point during every day, if you do a small act of service for someone else, if you do all of these things, I guarantee you the quality of your life is going to be better. That's just a right. fact.
With all of those things, embracing those things, first of all, the availability of those things is to some extent, to a large extent, dictated by the country you live in, the opportunities you have. But embracing those things, openness to experience, daringness, all that stuff is greatly influenced by what I'm talking about, your internal traits. I exercise all the time because I'm the kind of guy who really wants to exercise. And I don't have too much screen time.
I'm one of the guys who doesn't want to exercise all the time. And I do it anyway because I know it's important for my mental health. I am not wired to exercise every day. I'm wired to exercise once a month.
But right, the Wilsons store their energy and guard it. But the point is that, well, I don't want to say, and how happy are you? That's not the right question. The question is, judged against the baseline, you've been very honest about this, the anxiety that you've had all your life. You even called yourself, and Eric, you said we were flawed narrators to this quest. I disagree. I think you're the perfect narrators because you aren't just, you know, blissfully operating in the world unaware. And so what I'm saying is, yeah, you could probably raise your levels of happiness judged against the baseline. But in terms of just the pure absolute scale of happiness, I don't know. I don't know that all this stuff is elevating you above a person from, I don't know, Ghana who doesn't do any of this stuff is just generally more happy.
Well, Rain went to Ghana and they may not be, you know, in therapy and exercising, but they're moving, right? And they have these social relations. So it's sort of like if I said run 3 miles every day, it'll make you feel better. And you're like, no, I need to see the proof, the studies. You know, you don't need to read the studies that running 3 miles a day is going to make you feel better and be healthier. You just have to do it. And I think the people in Ghana and other places are just doing these things that we know make them happy. They just don't read as many, you know, self-help books and psychological studies about them.
Well, and when you boil it all down to, and I've shared this before, one of the things that I found in these travels is that it's all about connection. It's all about community. And that's where you really witnessed joy, meaning, you know, exaltation, transcendence, was families dancing together, friends eating together, people in service to one another, those Viking women in Iceland, hand in hand, singing at the top of their lungs, walking into the 50-degree Arctic Ocean every morning.
I think, for me at least, I think it's about stepping out of my comfort zone. And when we go in the sea, then it is difficult and it's always a challenge, even though Maka and I are very used to go in the sea now and we go 3 times a week. It's always a bit of a challenge. But then you think, I am doing this. I am going to do it. Mm. And there's nothing changing that. I'm here, I'm doing it. Then you can transfer that onto so many other things in life that are difficult or challenging.
These relationships really do increase happiness. And at a place like Ghana, like Eric says, they just come much more naturally to people. Like Ghanaians can't imagine their life, you know, in front of a computer screen and isolated. Like, you know, a quarter of young people in America are currently living their lives. And guess what? We're having the worst mental health crisis that we've had in world history.
Yeah. Do you think that the mental health crisis, the metrics that we have about it, things like ideas about suicide and depression, are those the best measures of the health of a society? Because as you said, Iceland, episode number one, very happy people, greatest amounts of depression and antidepressants.
I think they're not mutually exclusive. Switzerland, also one of the happiest countries in the world, also high suicide rate. In other words, you know, one Swiss person said to me, well, if you're not happy in Switzerland, you think, what's the point? You're comparing yourself to those happy people. But I think you're right. You are looking at a country pathologically when you talk about depression and suicide. You're not looking at what makes people happy. You're looking at the pathology. It's like a doctor that's only treating disease in a person and not all the wellness factors in them. So it is kind of a negative way of looking at things. And, you know, I think maybe you're better off having a country that has a lot of joy and contentment, but, you know, also people on antidepressants, also, unfortunately, people committing suicide. But overall, they're producing something more than a country that's just humming along at a very low base level, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And it was interesting when you said you don't need to read a study about going jogging, you just need to go jogging. Actually, I do read studies, and I interviewed Robert Waldinger, who is the director of the Harvard Medical School longest study of happiness ever conducted. And he told me, and his findings said, small interactions is what, Rain, you were talking about, community, even talking to the barista or talking to strangers, just getting into conversations, even these micro interactions really do correlate to happiness. So I began doing it and I began feeling a bit happier, or at least right after those interactions, they were 80% positive.
So you just shot down your thesis of 5 minutes ago.
No. I think that I am the kind of person who has the baseline character traits to be somewhere in, however you want to measure it, somewhere in the happy to very happy range. I also have anandamide, which means I don't really experience anxiety. That's a whole nother thing. I do experience sadness. I do experience worry when it's rational.
But are you a sociopath?
I'm not a sociopath.
Are there bodies in your closet and of your radio station?
No, I'm not. I do think that we have had many, many self-help ideas come down the pike, and in 12 years, they're all discarded for the next one. And there has lately been a trend. The number one class at Yale is a happiness class, and my friend Gretchen Rubin has a happiness podcast, and Dan Abrams has a happiness podcast, and you guys went searching the world for happiness. And there's stuff that can be found there. But I do think the big stuff is caricature traits, not being able to do an activity or think about things differently to will yourself into happiness. I saw one of the videos that Soul Pancake did about gratitude, either journaling or expressing gratitude. And then I read the studies on it, and I just don't believe that expressions of gratitude, they're nice. I mean, they're a little nice.
You don't believe the hard data that has been compiled about the effectiveness of gratitude? Because it is staggering. And if you talk to Dr. Lori Santos, who teaches that class at Yale, she will absolutely be able to, you should get her on the show, she will absolutely be able to back those studies up. And again, like, you keep saying this thesis, and I am telling you, Mike, that if I choose to live my life in a certain way, I can actively affect my happiness quotient, just in the same way that you said you decided, you made a choice to be more interactive with people, and that it actually worked and increased your happiness. And then when questioned about it, you were like, yeah, but I'm kind of programmed to be that way anyway.
This is turning into a brawl over happiness, which I find well, interesting.
I have read the data. There's a lot of conflicting empirical data, and I can't cite it to you. But, you know, things like, studies that showed that that compared a gratitude condition with neutral emotional condition, and present levels of gratitude did not evidence a relationship with well-being. They've done many, many studies that show that there might be a gratitude effect, and many other studies that show that they couldn't find a gratitude effect. And even those that show a gratitude effect don't show that it's enormous.
I go back to William James, who said, truth is what works. And I would say to you, try these things. Like, you know, go running for 3 miles a day, see if it makes you feel better. Try gratitude journaling, see if it makes you happier, experience happiness. So I do think you can't just read the studies and parse the data. You have to try these things, and the proof is in the pudding in what you do.
If it all worked, given the explosion of happiness research, why aren't we becoming happier?
That's a good question.
Well, I think that has to do with the main explosion with the mental health epidemic, with the loneliness epidemic, and that the Surgeon General is talking about. The increase in anxiety and depression among young people can be correlated, if you look at the hard data, from Dr. Jonathan Haidt and the work that he's doing, really around social media and screens. And that is the kind of neutron bomb that went off about 15 years ago that is, you know, 100% correlated with this mental health crisis, especially among teenage girls. So I think that's the, you know, you have a lot of happiness data coming out, and that can influence the dial a little bit, you know, 2 or 3%. And then you have this neutron bomb of social media and phones and people staring at checking their phones every 90 seconds and, you know, spending, you know, 3-4 hours a day looking at a screen. And that has some very serious deleterious effects.
Yeah. And actually, you asked the question, Mike, like, why aren't we happier? And my friend Dan Gilbert, who's a professor of psychology and happiness guru of sorts at Harvard, he doesn't know either. Look, because he says to people, like, we have all this data, we have all these studies, we know what you can do to make yourself happier. We know that staring at your phone and comparing yourself to beautiful people in LA is not going to make you happier, but we do it anyway. So we're kind of fucked up, if I can say that, Abunik, because we often act in ways contrary to what we know will make us happier. And I think a lot of experts throw up their arms. You know, why do we have the third cheeseburger when we know it's not going to make us feel as happy as the first cheeseburger? Why do we pursue wealth beyond a certain point when we know it doesn't really add to your happiness? So I don't know. It is kind of a mystery.
Rainn Wilson is the host of the new Peacock show, The Geography of Bliss. Eric Weiner is the author of the book of the same name. I do not know if this if agreeing to this interview made either of you happy, but in this weird way, it did that for me. So thank you so much.
No, listen, I appreciate healthy conflict and authentic conversation, and I believe that that can increase happiness. And I feel joy, Mike, that you have a show that allows the guests to kind of like get into it. And I think that's an awesome service. I'm thrilled to be a part of it. I love it.
And I've only
it's an important conversation. It really is. Sorry, Eric.
No, I've only experienced a slight uptick in happiness. No joy. But maybe that's because I know you too well. I don't know.
He expected it. He didn't warn you beforehand in another memo that was possibly read. Gentlemen, thank you so much. I too appreciated it. This is what I do or try to do. And this was great. So thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
And we should note, since suicide did come up in this interview, I wanted to mention 988. That is the suicide hotline. Just three numbers, 988. It works from any phone. It works from your mobile. If you or someone you know is feeling the need to call such a hotline, it is a useful service. And that's it for today's show. Corey Warr is the producer of The Gist, and Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is senior Bliss editor for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Lipson's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oopru, gpru, dupru, and thanks for listening.
Care for a piece of chocolate?
Chocolate? Where did you acquire it? That is a delicacy in the Amazon, but it has not yet been imported to the United States.
Who is the King of Austria?
Joseph II.
Who is the King of Prussia?
Friedrich Wilhelm III.
Who is the King of England?
Why, the tyrant King George, of course.
I don't care what Jim says. That is not the real Ben Franklin. I am 99% sure.